No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I am joined by my co-host, Kathleen Gomez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in our discussion. We want this to be a discussion, and you can call in at 888-429-5471, or you can Skype us at BBS Radio 2. That's Bob Sam Radio 2. Today, we have a special guest, Dr. James Miller. Dr. Miller is a public education advocate, activist, professor, and independent scholar. He has taught sociology and African American studies at Wayne State University, the University of Detroit, California State University, and UCLA. He was a senior research associate at the National Institute for Education, focusing on creating a five-year national research program on the social and cultural foundation of education. And he starts, this is the most exciting part, he starts his own show on BBS Radio next month on Sundays at 4 o'clock, so he'll be on before us, right here on the BBS Radio Network, entitled The War on Public Education.
I believe that's 2 o'clock.
Oh,
I hate to interrupt you, Ms. Senator Brown, because we know that's 2.
Wait a second. I would like to point out that you provided me with that information.
I would like to point out that you took it down wrong.
Oh, I don't know. This is a discussion for another show. But, okay, 2 o'clock, even better.
Okay.
And before I introduce Dr. Miller, let me introduce Kathleen Gomez, who's already introduced herself and corrected me before we got on the air, who is in Arizona, where it is nice and warm, which
yes,
annoys me even more than being corrected, because here in Washington, it's nice and cold. So hi, Kathleen. Thanks for getting the conversation started.
Yes, Senator Brown. Yes, it is beautiful weather in Arizona, I must say. It's like, I think, 75, 78, blue skies. It's been that way since I got back. When I left D.C., it was, what, -7? So
yeah.
I hate to say that it's been that way the whole, like, 3 weeks, going on almost a month now. But I have to say, I want to give a shout-out to Miss Patty Brown for running her she's got a very conditioned body, so I was going to say her tight ass up there to get you a modem so you can be online. So we need to give a shout out to your wife, not only because she's a wife, she puts up with you, but because she comes in and saves the day.
And she's usually the one telling me I'm wrong rather than you are. And I know that you're younger than I am, so it must be that it was the new math. It was 4 o'clock, and you think, you know, 4 is 2 to you.
Right.
But anyway.
Station 1. Not station 2. We're station 2, and Dr. Miller's going to be on station 1.
Oh, he is?
Yes, he is.
Oh,
another thing I had wrong.
Well, you're going to have to go back and forth then between the stations. But anyway, Dr. Miller, before we get into a fight and then my wife gets involved, let's say hello to Dr. Miller and get him on the air. Dr. Yes. Miller, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
I'm fine, and thanks for inviting me.
So tell
Kathleen,
me, Doc.
Yes,
oh,
I'm
sorry,
sir.
Go ahead.
I say this. I'm going to join in on Kathleen's side. I was going to try and correct him, but I'm so glad that you did it for me.
No problem. I have to steer us, you know, on the right path a lot of times, but
yeah,
he is a senator. He's a politician. You know, he kind of thinks that he knows it all. So no, not. I just didn't want anyone to get it wrong, Dr. Miller. I wanted them to be able to find you.
And you know what they say, Dr. Miller, behind every good man is a woman telling him he's wrong. So tell us, Dr. Miller, what is the war on public education? What do you see? I know you and I have talked about this a little bit, and I wholeheartedly agree with you that there's a war on public education. But can you give us a brief description of what you mean by that for our listeners?
What I mean is there's a war, and what wars are all about: fighting, winning, yep, losing, casualties, power, and et cetera, that is going on, has been going on for a while, over who will control public education and basically the funds, the potential trillion-plus dollars that this country spends on public education.
Well, I know in Washington, I'm sorry, go ahead.
From pre-K all the way up to PhD.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I know in Washington, D.C., on public schools, including public charter schools, we spend somewhere in excess of $800 million a year. I don't know if it's our single largest budget outlay, but it's got to be close. We have a $12 billion budget. So it's almost 10% of our budget that was spent on public education. And you know what? The truth is we're not getting the job done. We got 41% of our kids that don't graduate from high school in 4 years. There are some kids in the poorer neighborhoods, primarily African-American students, who are dropping out at greater than 50% out of some of our high schools. It's more likely that you'll drop out of Anacostia High School than it is that you'll finish at Anacostia High School. And I know you're familiar with the education system in Washington, and that's why I point that out. So what are the sides in the war? Who's on what side?
Well, let me comment on what you just said. When you said schools are not doing their job, and you refer to the dropout rate, that is really almost part and parcel of the argument and the war. It is centered around the school's failure, teacher failure, to educate the nation's children, and that if we eliminate the teachers, quote, bad teachers, and all teachers are almost all the teachers are bad teachers, and close down the schools and create private schools in the form of charters and others, then that will solve the crises. And that's a false, very false statement.
Right.
It borders on propaganda. So that's part of what I talk about when I talk about the war.
Well, I'm going to turn this.
Yeah, because you know I'm biting at the. I'm just sitting here all antsy. You know, Dr. Miller, when I was in New York City for 20 years, my sons were in public education, and I got very involved because of the class size. My son was 7 years old taking a test on the floor because there weren't, you know, enough chairs, and the classroom was about, you know, 38, 40 kids. And I got real involved. I was on the what they now call the Community Education Council of District 2. It was the new school board. But some of the things that, you know, we were dealing with is, you know, the bringing in of these charter schools that took so much money, you know, and it was these fancy names coming from the Hamptons. You know, they wanted to start their own school, so they would come into a public school and literally take over two floors and have all the kids would have everything, you know, laptops and everything, while the regular public school went with nothing. And New York, you know, was one of the best school systems. And they created great scholars and scientists and everything. So I there's so many things I want to ask you about. One of the things I was wondering, what do you think of that No Child Left Behind? I mean, isn't this a policy that just basically put us on a fast track to testing and where we no longer had arts and music and PE and that type of thing.
Yes, it was wrong to start with. And it was so incredibly wrong that so many politicians on both sides of the aisle supported it and launched it. And we see today how wrong the whole concept was and its implementation. It has caused many of the problems that we have today. And it, I think, and I think many people will agree with me who study this area, in this area, that it was No Child Left Behind. It really launched this current phase of a long, long-term war on public education.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I got to know Jane Hirschman, who started an organization called Time Out from Testing, but I saw in the years just how much, I mean, you know, they just let all kind of after-school programs go, like drama and chess club, to create tutorials, places where they could train the kids, and this is even in the high school where my son, back in Arizona, that you just, so you could take the test, because everything now revolves on the test scores of a school, on how much money they get, and if the state comes over and takes control, and it's just horrible. How do you feel about charter schools?
I'm not a supporter of charter schools.
Yeah, me neither.
The original idea for charters was that teachers would be able to come together, form a school that would be a public school, but they would be able to run it in a way that they felt was the best way to educate at the moment. It was going to be more like an experimental school. And from there, things learned, improvements would be hopefully made, and those improvements eventually would be scaled up back to the traditional public school. That was the original idea. What we have today is a whole different animal. Today, charter schools are basically private schools operating off of public dollars.
That's right.
It's a vehicle to allow people to, quote, send their kids to private schools and have you and I and the rest of the public pay for it.
Well, you know, the thing that drives me crazy, Dr. Miller, and you and I talked about this briefly off the air, is this idea that parents can educate their children in charter schools, that we actually have these boards of parents coming together to educate children. And I understand the frustration with bad schools. As you well know, in Washington, D.C., we have more charter schools than any city in America except for New Orleans. And the only reason that New Orleans beat us out was because of Katrina. Charter schools were almost a necessity down there at one point. And here in Washington, we have all these schools that are run by parents, and it seems to me to be just crazy. I mean, we wouldn't ask a bunch of parents to come in and run the fire department or run the police department or run any other part of government, but yet we're allowing them to run the schools, and we're taking educators out of the mix when it comes to making the big decisions about which way we're going to go in education. That just seems crazy to me. Doesn't that seem crazy to you?
It does. I agree with you almost wholeheartedly. I could go on for a decade on this topic.
Yeah.
Parents who, in some cases, I almost want to say many cases, because when I was growing up, what I'm about to say would be true, parents who didn't even get an education.
Yes.
A high school or a middle school, who can now come in and vote to take over a school and run a school. It's insane to me But it's part of the war. It's one of the major strategies, weapons, that help fuel and run the war.
It's interesting because in New York, what we were seeing were people who had no public education. They hadn't gotten a master's in it, but were creating schools based on the fact that they had a lot of money. And one of my problems, what I was seeing, was that parents did not have any input in the charter schools that were started in New York City. And there's a lot of them in New York City now. I mean, it was an amazing to have two schools in the same physical building, one having a lot, you know, laptops and uniforms and beautiful, you know, they went in and painted the rooms and nice chairs. And then with the regular public schools where it was overcrowded, they didn't have any kind of laptops or even a computer. So it's interesting. I don't know how it's changed in New York since I've been gone. But let me ask you, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, how do you deal with how, like, Arizona is 48th in the state as far as the money spent on their students and, you know, the quality of education, 48th. And why cannot this be something that's across the board? Shouldn't everyone have the same quality of education? Because that way we're giving them a great foundation is what I think. And become productive citizens. But when you have this imbalance, you know, Connecticut and Massachusetts are 1 and 2, and then everyone in between, and I know Arizona's 48th, you know, in the country. Why is it that way?
Kathleen, you hit on several different things, all related but different. Let me go back to the way we spend money on education. It differs from state to state. Some will per student allocation. Some will base it on property tax revenue in a given city, county, to fund education. And in that latter situation, where you have areas where you have pockets of very wealthy communities who can afford to pay taxes on more expensive property, that district will have more money to spend on education versus a district across the street where the property values are low, the tax base is low, their ability to spend money on education is less than their neighbor's ability to do so. In states where it's based upon a per-child allocation, you have situations where the wealthier districts can, again, take the money that the states provide and add money to it in order to pump up the amount of money that they have to spend per child on education, hence creating a differential funding base. This has been part and parcel of public education financing from the very beginning. The inequality that it can exist and does exist from state to state, from district to district within states. Most states, and I'm pretty sure when I say most, but all states have in their constitution the requirement that the state provides funding for education. And it's almost interpreted as equal amount of funding for education across the state. States don't adhere to that, and many states have been and are being sued to make states spend equal amount of money across the state. So politics rears its head into the formula. So that's one of the reasons why I think you don't see equal amounts of money being spent across the country to provide a quality education, not just education, but a quality of education.
Well, let me just—I have a couple of questions that have sprung up in my mind from the things that you and Kathleen have just said. And one of them is: isn't this why we supposedly created the Common Core, to try to even out the education, to provide standards that every state, I know that every state does not participate, but that could provide a framework so that we can equalize education from state to state. Wasn't that the idea behind it, number one? And number two, do you think this variation in funding based on the state is just an extension of racism from the past because it has a desperate impact on poor people?
Wow, you're hitting me with a lot at one time. Let me try and break it up and respond accordingly.
Okay.
With the Common Core, Common Core was, quote, in theory, was supposed to be a set of standards by which every state and all the school districts within a state would teach a common curriculum.
Uh-huh.
Hence the word Common Core. It would be a core set of ideas, principles that schools would teach per each grade all across the country, so that a child in Massachusetts, a child in New Orleans, a child in Michigan would all be on the same page curriculum-wise, and they will all be subject to trying to be educated to a certain common standard. That was what was stated. In reality, that's a lie.
Mm-hmm.
My opinion, that's a lie. Common Core was created by the literature stated the following. You had one super billionaire by the name of Bill Gates who wanted this notion of the Common Core, who got the president and the Secretary of Education to go along with this. They, in turn, pushed it. Bill Gates got governors or states to go along with this idea, then went out and got non-educators to write or develop these standards. Governors of the 48 states signed on to them, sight unseen in most cases.
Wow.
They just signed on to them. Then the standards were promoted as the solution to not inequality. It was the solution to raising the academic achievement of all American students to a level of that of the higher scoring nations of the world who have passed the U.S. in terms of having quality, educated future workers. So
well,
that's the common... Okay.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dr. Miller. Finish.
So the Common Core had quite a different real purpose or hidden agenda than the agenda that is put out as the reason for the Common Core and how it's supposed to work and et cetera. Your last question was about eradicating inequality.
Yes.
I think that could nothing can be further than the truth than what you just stated. If anything, the Common Core will highlight and exaggerate the inequality. And that is part and parcel of what the Common Core, I think, was designed for behind closed doors.
So well, is it, I'm sorry, wait, Kathleen, just one last question. So is it a bad idea or is it a good idea that's been implemented poorly? Or just a bad idea altogether?
I would say the way in which the idea of developing a super curriculum, that could be, and underscore, could be a good idea. But there's always been an unwillingness for the government, the federal government, to implement a national curriculum, national policy. That was supposed to be left up to the states and then the districts. In a democratic country, you're supposed to be able to make those decisions at the local level. So the idea of a national curriculum is counter to a democratic view of what our country is supposed to be about and the role of the government in education. So I would have to say it was a bad idea.
Well, let me ask you this. I'm sorry. I just wanted to ask you one quick thing about the Common Core. You know, I had seen a little bit about it, and I saw that teaching children to write in school, to use cursive or script, whatever you want to call it, is not part of the program, not part of the curriculum. And maybe because you were saying Bill Gates was part of this movement, I guess the thinking is that nobody will ever have to write again because they're going to be on iPods or computers or phones. I just don't understand that, because I still think that being able to write and know how to write a letter and write a sentence, you're not getting that through your computer. You're not learning the basics of writing. So how can that not be part of the curriculum?
Well, you can't blame Common Core for that. Exactly. There were people who were saying we no longer need to teach children how to write because of what you said, keyboard, and being able to Twitter, where you don't need to know how to write. I think it's one of the dumbest things to come about in a long time. I just don't understand it either.
Yeah, I don't either.
As far as I'm concerned.
It just, you know, and the way these kids are writing on Tweet and, you know, Facebook, you know, I mean, it's all kind of phonics, I guess, you know, you are as you are, and B is not B-E, but B, I mean, and it goes even, you know, on to where you're looking at a sentence and it doesn't look anything like what I know about. But I guess the thing that still bothers me, and you pretty much explain it, Dr. Miller, but Michael, when you look at like a whole state of Arizona that's 48th in what it spends on education, I don't think it's racism. I think it's a political lack of will to see that, because it's not sexy. Educating children for some reason is not seen as something that should be on the foremost of what politicians do. And it just, I don't know where if we're going to ever come to the point. Because, you know, and our problem, I think, in Arizona is we have a lot of retirees that come here, and they've already educated their children. They've paid their taxes in North Dakota or Michigan. And when they come to Arizona, they don't want to have an increase in taxes. Right. So they vote a lot of our bonds down that would help schools. And it amazes me, because if you don't educate these kids are going to be burglarizing your nice, you know, what do we call them, snowbirds, the snowbirds' homes. So it's such a lack of understanding that if we educate our children, they're going to be our tax base. They're going to contribute to Social Security. It's a no-win. It's just a win-win situation to have education funded so that we can compete. When you brought up the fact that we're so behind, you know, I think we were like 32 in science or 28th in math, and it goes on and on. Why is that, do you think? Why are we so far behind our European countries and Asian countries?
Well, I let me just say that I agree with you. And in Washington, D.C., we have the opposite effect. We had a mayoral election 4 years ago that very much, as Dr. Miller knows because he's familiar with Michelle Rhee, one of the big issues was education. And I think you're right, Kathleen. I think it's for the opposite reason, that we have a lot of – we're getting 1,200 new young people in every month in the District of Columbia. So I think that education is a big issue to them because they're just starting families and they care about schools. So, yeah, I'm sure that's one of the reasons in Arizona. Let me say we're going to take a break for a second. First of all, I want to point out that Kathleen, I understand why you're upset about the whole cursive thing, because Kathleen has beautiful handwriting. And when she was in school, she learned to do it with a chisel and a hammer.
That's right.
They hadn't invented paper yet. But we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and continue our conversation with Dr. Miller. We're so happy he's here. And please think of questions that you want to ask Dr. Miller. You don't get an opportunity to talk to a guy who has these kind of credentials every day. So think about questions for him. Call in or Skype us, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Here's a song that puts it all in perspective by Pink Floyd, Another Brick in the Wall.
Jack, keep your hands off my stack. New car, caviar, four-star daydream. Think I'll buy me a football team. Absolute rubbish, laddie. Get on with your work. Repeat after me. An acre is the area of a rectangle whose length is 1 furlong and whose width is 1 cake.
And we're back, and we're here to put another brick in the wall of education, and we're going to let Kathleen, before she wrestles me to the ground, ask the next question of Dr. Miller.
Well, there's so many, but we were talking. There's a couple things I'd like you to talk about, and one of I have like a two-part question. One of them is, of course, creativity in our schools. When we've lost art and music and even PE, and I know having boys, oh my gosh, they have to be able to get some of that energy out because they cannot focus all day. You know what that's done to our students. And then the fact about libraries, we were talking during the break, you know, everyone's like, well, I have a Kindle. I don't need to buy a book. You know, back in the day, I can't afford a Kindle. I don't think there's a lot of people in poor areas that can afford these types of technological things that now say, well, we don't need books anymore. You know, the librarians and the libraries are kind of becoming non-existent, and I think that's going to be another big rift in inequality of education. Dr. Miller, what do you think about those two subjects?
Which one of those do you want me to take?
Because it's going to take an hour. Well, yeah. I guess the library. Talk about the library.
I was just joking. Let me go for it. The first part of your question, you're talking about the humanities. The humanities are looked on by some people as being totally irrelevant, unnecessary in the education of students. That's a view or vision that has been around, a competing vision, I should say, been around for decades. And it comes very close to asking what I think is a central question in all of this, and that is, what is our vision of public education in a democracy? It's the most fundamental question from which all issues eventually spring from. What do we think education should be, the purpose of education should be in a democracy? Is it to raise children, send them to school, to be trained, to come out as young adults, be obedient, and be able to work proficiently in the workplace according to the needs of the economy? Or do we see ourselves educating our children to grow up to be happy, healthy, curious, imaginative, and good people contributing to a good democracy?
Well, you know what? I'm sorry, Dr. Miller. I think the latter is what we all think. You know, there's that gap between theory and practice. And I think in theory, we all think the latter, but I think that, you know, we leave it up to you to tell us, but I think that we're really getting the former when it gets down to it. We really want job training. But, you know, in political science, when you study political science, we talk about education, as you well know, because you're a sociologist, among other things. We often talk about it as socializing children to become good citizens, to integrating them into society. And I think that the most dangerous person in our society is a person that has no vested interest. You know, they're a danger to themselves, they're a danger to the community, and they're a danger to America. If you don't make them part of the system, part of the process, and people can't, have a piece of the pie, let's say, then they have nothing left to lose. They have no reason to participate. They have no reason to be law-abiding.
But I think the worst thing is to be training like you were. I think what you're trying to say is the humanities, I hadn't thought of it that way. We need to have them human so that, you know, I think what we're doing is training them to be, like you say, like the Japanese. And maybe that's why the Japanese do so well, because they're trained so rigid, you know, diligently to be like a robot. And that's what we Americans were great for, the creativity and being imaginative and thinking outside of the box. And I fear that we're losing that. Can you follow up with the whole issue of books and libraries and librarians?
Well, that's part of the elimination of the humanities in our curriculum. First to go would be the libraries, music department, art department, and you, Mike, you have said PE, loss of PE. These right. are subjects that are not relevant depending upon your vision of public education.
Well, you know something, the thing that sticks out in my mind in what you said, Dr. Miller, is happy. You know, don't we really want to create people that are happy and fulfilled? And I think if you want to do that, you need to look at the whole person and create the whole person. And, you know, I often said when we talked, my kids are in college, Kathleen's got a son in college. I realized when we were going through the whole college process with our kids that there was all this pressure on them to go to the right school or the best school. And I kept saying to my wife, you know, I went to a state university and I know lots of people that went to really good schools like Yale, Harvard, Princeton, Ivy League schools, and they don't seem any happier than I am. And I wonder, are we focusing on the wrong thing? Should we focus on making our kids happy and fulfilled and well-rounded and not worry about so much about the credentials and the, you know, the kind of minutiae of their education, but look more at the whole person?
Well, that would follow up, Dr. Miller. What do you think of the price of going to university now, you know, where it's costing, you know, at University of Arizona, it's $40,000 a year, just tuition, not the books, not the dorm, not nothing else. Isn't this something that is also kind of very scary, this trend of paying so much for college?
It's a nightmare. It's beyond scary. It's a nightmare. When I was going to school in college, junior college here in California was, I think, my each semester, I paid a total of $10. Yeah. And that was for student fees, health insurance, and student union fees, like $250 a piece or something like this. And that you could take five classes, six classes for that amount of money. Here in California, I'm from Michigan, born and raised in Detroit. We didn't have community colleges. So when I started school, my first year, freshman year, I did it in Michigan. And it was still basically cheap. Coming out here, it was non-existent in terms of what I had to pay. It was almost like a joke. Today, they're charging $100 a unit, $300 for a course at the community college level.
Right.
Going to, well, a state university costs $12,000 to $14,000, I think, for the UC, University of California system. And then on top of that, the various fees that are added on, so that you're looking at maybe $20,000. And if you're out of state, you're looking at almost doubling that.
Right.
It's almost unconscionable to me.
Yes, me too. And I want to tell you that I paid every dime of my education from the day I started through a master's degree. And I came out of school $1,000 in debt after paying all this. And I had a part-time job at a clothing store. I mean, I think I made $3 an hour. And I was able to do that because, like you say, at community college, it cost me, where I started, it cost me $400 a semester. When I got to the state university, the price went up to $500 a semester. But that was something that I could do myself. I've got a kid at DePaul where it's $40,000 a year. She wouldn't be able to pay for herself to go through college. It would be impossible.
And there's so many parents that can't afford. I mean, right. It's just very scary. Well, you know, Dr. Miller, tell us what your show. You're going to have a show that starts February the 23rd, and it's called A War on Public Education. Can you tell us what your show is going to be about, or, you know, the format of it, and people can call in, or what, you know, give us a little more detail?
Well, the idea behind the show is that, as I said earlier, there is what I believe and characterize as a real war going on over who will control public education in this country. The competing visions with competing missions for education. And at this point in the war is between what are called the corporate reformers versus the more, I guess, traditional educators. And the traditional educators are losing out to the corporate reformers. And what I want to do is to describe this war, basically the anatomy of the war, breaking it down to its various components and et cetera, along the lines of what it is, why it is, how it is, the consequences or the cost of the war, what our country will look like depending on who wins this war 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, and do this at a level for the general public who is in the main not aware of the war being waged and all of the many motivations, values that are in conflict, so that when it comes time to elect officials at the local level, state level, the national level, who are playing a huge role in this war, the public will know what the issues really are and will hopefully make informed decisions so that when they vote, they will be voting with full knowledge of what's at stake.
Well, let me tell you. Yeah, and let me tell you, Dr. Miller, I think this is a really important show that you're doing, because I think as a politician, as an elected official, that people are being sold a bill of goods. We always want to be told that prosperity's around the corner. It's like the political the most overused political mantra. And I think when we get politicians up there that say, we're going to save you money and we're going to give your kids better education, and they really don't need sports and they really don't need libraries. They don't need libraries. They have computers. They don't need libraries. The lie in that statement is that whether they need libraries or not, they need librarians. They need people to show them it's not just about accessing information. It's about, as you know, as an educator, it's about how you use that information and how you integrate it into the whole of your education and your available knowledge to work on things. So I think people are being sold a bill of goods by politicians who are always trying to make you feel like they can do it for less and they can do it more efficiently. It's the first thing we always say. Well, how are you going to pay for that, Senator? I'm going to cut out government waste. Well, you know what? We've been cutting out government waste for 200 years, and the government's still wasting a boatload of money. So that's not the road.
And I think we can't end this show without asking you, Dr. Miller, the state of teachers. I commented to you that, in a small town on the Mexican border where it's very hard to attract teachers, we have a situation where we can't get a chemistry teacher, can't get a physics teacher, and have people teaching who do not even have teaching certificates. They are every other kind of, maybe a fireman, they were an ex-policeman, and they're teaching first grade. I know this is happening in this town, my hometown of Douglas. A retired policeman is teaching first grade, which just astounds me, and he doesn't have any kind of a teacher certificate. What is the state of the teachers now, and how do we deal with this?
Well, the state is very bad. That's part of the war. And one of the major strategies of the war from what the corporate reform side is to get rid of teachers and replace those experienced teachers, especially the senior teachers, because they make more money. You get rid of them, and they bring in people from who maybe do have college degrees, but nowhere near the subject matter of teaching and the practice experience of teaching, put them in classrooms for a year or 2 years, and they leave, and you bring in more first recruits to replace them, to the point where all the normal teachers who were trained to be teachers, who have been teaching what have you, have been displaced. That's part and parcel of one major part of the objective of the reform movement, is to get rid of teachers, get rid of teachers, colleges or colleges of education that prepares teachers. They badmouth the schools that train teachers. They badmouth the teachers. It's called propaganda, so that then the legislatures will attack teachers by getting rid of tenure. So we have job insecurity as opposed to job security. One state is notorious for saying that we no longer are going to pay additional for extra education. For getting a master's degree, you get nothing. Getting a doctorate, you get nothing more than you would get had you just had a bachelor's degree. Devaluing the teaching profession, anyone can teach. That fireman that you mentioned, the police that you mentioned, that person who majored in whatever, anyone, the person coming off the street, teaching is not a professional job. Robots, computers can replace teachers. So the plight of teachers is very bad today, and it's getting worse as part of what the war is aimed at. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah,
well,
it does.
You know, I'd love to know, and I don't know if you know the answer to this question, Dr. Mill, but I'd love to know how these Teach for America teachers do, because it seems like there's a big trend here in Washington, as you well know, with the Michelle Reed push that we had, to use these Teach for America kind of teachers, students that weren't particularly trained as teachers who go into a brief training and then come into the public schools. Are these people that stay, or do you know? Do they stay? Do we retain?
No, most
people?
Of them don't stay.
Yeah.
The Teach for America idea is you get the best and the brightest from the Ivy League schools.
Right.
And you get them to come into the program. You train them for 5 weeks, and then you throw them into, quote, the ghetto schools.
Right.
And they are supposed to be the solution because they are the best and brightest. They're untrained. In many cases, they don't get any support beyond that 5 weeks of training. And many of them drop out the first year, second year. And I think the statistics says the majority of those people who start are gone by year three. And so that you have a constant turnover of teachers.
Yeah.
So that Teach for America is the answer to the poor training preparation that people get who go to schools that offer majors in education or a graduate school that offers master's and credentialing in education, who have 3, 4, 5 years and also maybe teaching experience as a trainee before they get into their first classroom. Compare that to a person who has 5 weeks and no education in how to teach.
Right. And, you know, that's something I think that we don't understand. I think that we all experienced in college, right, professors who were brilliant people, who wrote books, but weren't particularly good teachers. And then there were other people who were just fabulous teachers. I mean, there's something about being a teacher. It's not just having the information in your head, it's being able to transmit that to students. And that's not something you pick up on the street. And I would say it's not something you pick up in 5 weeks in a junior training course. I think it's something that you know, is cultivated over a long time.
Well, I think everyone has a story or a memory of a teacher who changed their life.
Right.
Who made a difference in their life and kept them in school or told them that they could do anything, you know, and that's what kids need. And especially, I would think, even more so. And, you know, I know our time is going, but one of the things I also wanted to talk to you about was about class size. You know, It's funny, the governor of Pataki in New York once stated that New York State only obligation to children were to educate them to eighth grade. And at that same time, the class sizes were like, 35 to 40. Do you think class size has an impact on teaching in public schools?
Definitely. Class size matters. Right. I know we're out of time.
But yeah, we are.
This. Everything that we talked about, I will talk about on my show in depth.
Great.
Sometimes maybe a series over a week or two or three, because these are issues that are crucially important now and for the future.
Well, I think everyone should listen to your show at 2 o'clock on Station 1 and then come over and hear our show starting, at 4 o'clock California time on Station 2, because I will be listening to your show because, I just think that, having someone help us understand it and maybe giving us a way to understand that voting and being involved is so important. And people have to get off the couch and they have to go and find out who's going to be running for these positions that's going to impact our future.
Well, we want to thank you, Dr. Miller, for coming.
Yes.
This was very much impromptu. We didn't take a lot of time to prepare for this because we had the opportunity to have Dr. Miller, so we jumped at that. And just like Kathleen, I think that everybody should listen to your show. I hope you'll tune in at 2 o'clock. I'm going to tune in at 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock just to make sure I don't miss it. And I want to say thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And in Kathleen's case, that special teacher that intervened and made a difference in her life was a man named Plato. And she'll never forget him.
Hey,
and
only from the best. Only from the
best.
That's
right.
Well, thank good retort.
Dr. Miller.
Good retort, Kathleen. Good retort.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Miller. And thank you, America, for listening. Continue to listen. We promise to have Dr. Miller on again so we can talk about class size and other things. And make sure you listen to the War on Education, which starts February 23rd at 2 o'clock. Thank you, America. We'll see you next week.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.